All right, tonight we're going to discuss the emergence of right-wing orthodoxy in America.
Over the past 2 weeks, we've discussed the emergence of American orthodoxy. The first session, we spoke about immigrant orthodoxy, especially after the beginning of the great wave of immigration in 1881, and we spoke about Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, Jacob Joseph, the attempt at having a chief rabbi. And then last time we spoke about the modernized orthodoxy of the interwar years. Characters like Rabbi Joseph Lookstein, Herbert Goldstein, Leo Jung. And what I want to emphasize tonight is that there's a piece missing in the generally told story. The usual story is that the immigrant Orthodox tried to preserve the ways of the past, but basically failed. That the rabbis, most of them were associated with the Agudas Rabbanim, were predominantly resistors to modernity, with a handful of very prominent accommodators at the very top, and that style of religion could not satisfy the next generation, and so perforce there was a modernized element in the next generation among those who bothered to sustain sincere religious attachment. And that interwar modern orthodoxy was a bit of a watered-down orthodoxy, but with an emphasis towards the end upon building up of day schools, emphasis on Zionism, teaching the Hebrew language, the role of the Mizrahi, and that the modernized orthodoxy of the interwar years did not sustain itself unblemished, because after the war there was arrival of refugees, DPs, from Holocaust survivors, who brought with them a more intense fervor, a greater devotion to the minutiae of halacha, and also after 1956, the arrival of Hungarians, who brought with them all sorts of chumras, and so that the face of orthodoxy changed. There's a lot of truth to that narrative, but there's a missing link, and that is the beginning of Hasidism and the yeshivas, the elite yeshivas. I don't mean elementary school yeshivas, but the advanced yeshivas in the United States. So that's what we're going to focus on tonight. In Brooklyn of the interwar period, the various social elements of orthodoxy could be broken down as follows. You had Talmud Torah orthodoxy, kids who went to public school, but who went to a strong Talmud Torah where they learned a fair amount and were able to participate fully in Jewish life. There were those handful, not a very large number, who went to the modernized day schools. And then there were those who went to the more frum day schools, like Torah Vadas and Chaim Berlin. But all these categories of people met each other in the same social environments, even if not in the same educational environment. They could all gather at the Young Israel and be friends. So at least in my family's lore, cousin Maxie went to Chaim Berlin, but he only went for lunch. Why? Because it was like a Hefkerveld. It wasn't a well-run school. It was an old-line school. And so if you wanted to just show up for lunch and miss all the shiurim, you could get away with it. As opposed to my Uncle Mickey, my mother's Uncle Mickey, who they say, oh, he was a yeshiva boy. He wasn't a yeshiva boy. He went to public school. He went to Thomas Jefferson High School. But because he went to the Newlands Talmud Torah, and then he went to Herzliya afterwards for high school, he was the functional equivalent of a yeshiva boy, and he knew everybody from the Young Israel. So people who went to Chaim Berlin, public school, Crown Heights yeshiva, could all gather in the same sviva. But did there exist a crowd of people that was beyond that social element, that was more parochial in their interests, with greater emphasis on high-level Talmud Torah, and eschewing modernity? So the answer is there were such people. Not very many, but there were such people. The first historical character I want to mention of this sort is Rabbi Gabriel Z. Margolis. Not to be confused with Moshe Zvulun Margolis, the Ramaz. Oh, they were bitter enemies. Although they had roughly the same last name, they were bitter enemies. Gabriel Margolis came to America in 1907, and he was not a team player. If the Agudas HaRabbanim wanted to corner the market on kashrus, he wanted to break up the monopoly. He was a trust buster in that regard. And so in 1920, he organized the Knesset HaRabbanim Orthodoxim and other ephemeral organizations that came and went.
Where was he from?
He was from Galicia. And he attacked the Agudas Rabbanim
as being a union of kashrus gangsters and unqualified rabbis, that he was the most learned of them all.
He wasn't wrong.
Well, I don't know whether he was right or wrong. The gangster, maybe. He was known as Reb Velvel. Reb Velvel was his nickname. And he got into the sacerdotal wine business during Prohibition. He was giving out bogus smicha certificates to 18, 19, and 20-year-old yeshiva boys so that they could then pass themselves off before the federal authorities as clergymen who could deal in the wine trade. He attacked Rietz as being a smicha factory. Here's the pot calling the kettle black. Here he was giving out bogus certificates for the purposes of making parnassa, and he was attacking Rietz as not being a real yeshiva, but rather being a theological seminary that was pumping out pulpit rabbis, unqualified pulpit rabbis.
He gave up on us, this guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Okay.
A lot of money in that.
Yeah, yeah. He was also extremely anti-Zionist. Why do I bring that up? Because, and this gets lost in the study of the history sometimes, the Agudas HaRabbanim, although they were old world rabbis, were almost all Zionists, fervent Zionists, disciples or colleagues of Rav Reines, students of the Rabbi Yitzchak Kahn Inspector or the Netziv, and they did not share the staunch anti-Zionism of, let's say, the Soloveitchik, the Brisker side of the Soloveitchik family, or the other Admorim of Poland. These were men oriented towards the Mizrahi. And here comes along Gabriel Margolis, and he's a Fabrenta anti-Zionist, the likes of which we wouldn't see in America until Satmar comes along. All right? So he's out of the ordinary. What about Hasidim? Are there Hasidim in America before World War II?
Yes.
So, of course, the answer has to be yes, because Jews of all types were part of the great wave of immigration. The better question is, was there Hasidic life in America before World War II? It's one thing to have a handful of people scattered around who had Hasidic roots in the old world, but was there Hasidus in America? So, a few names need to be mentioned. The Biyana Rebbe, Mordechai Shlomo Friedman, okay, born 1891, comes to America in 1926 and was the dean of the Hasidic Admorim in America until his death in 1971. So for a good 45 years at a 247 East Broadway in the Lower East Side, he held court with his Hasidus. The Biyana Rebbe, yeah.
Give us some numbers. The Biyana Rebbe had...
So how many Hasidim did he have? 100? 200?
Wow.
But when I say he had Hasidim, that doesn't mean they dressed in typical Hasidic fashion. It could just be these were people who, from their old homes, were near his court, and they were under his influence, or the influence of the Rishna Admorim in general, because there's several lines of Hasidus that come together. And although they Americanized, they still had a soft spot in their heart for the Rebbe. How do we know this was true? How do we know this is true? Because who was his successor when he died in 1971? Okay, so when the Biyana Rebbe died, there was no successor. His son Izzy Israel Friedman, who was married to Natalie Lookstein, Haskell Lookstein's sister, Joseph Lookstein's daughter, was not interested in being the Rebbe. He was a clean-shaven, modern Orthodox Jew, a member of KJ. And he wasn't about to become a Hasidish Rebbe. But he still was an administrator of the yeshiva. He did a lot of important work on behalf of the Hasidus, but he wasn't going to take it on. And as for his sister, she had married Professor Menachem Breyer of YU. So who's going to be the Rebbe? There is no one. Everybody becomes Modernish. Everyone's an American Jew. So Breyer's son, Nachum Dov, becomes the Rebbe. They groom him. He's born 1958-59. They groom him after his bar mitzvah to take over that lifestyle. And in 1984, at the age of 25, he becomes the Rebbe. American born and raised. And now he lives in Israel and has a big Hasidus there, big following. Okay. So, but I bring this as an example that you could have an early arriving Admor, a Rebbe,
But when you come too early, before you can have a court filled with long-bearded and kaftan-wearing Jews, the inevitable result is that even your own family goes with the flow of American Orthodox life. Okay. Another example of a Rebbe who came before the war was the Kapishnitzer Rebbe.
Yep.
Avram Yeshua Heschel, the cousin of Avram Yeshua Heschel of JTS. Okay, he comes in 1939 to Henry Street, Lower East Side, and holds court there for a long time, although I think he moves to Brooklyn, I think he moved to Borough Park sometime in the late 50s, if I'm not mistaken. Were there other Hasidus?
Also, well, 100
Hasidus. Small group, nothing big.
Majids?
I don't know when Majid's came. I think after the war. I think after. But I don't think they were in America. They were in Canada, but I don't think they came to the New York area until after the war. Lubavitch. What about Lubavitch? So the beginnings of a Lubavitch presence in Crown Heights was in 1925, when Israel Jacobson, Rabbi Israel Jacobson, bought a place to live and established a shul, and that was the beginnings, the kernel that would later flower with the arrival of the Rebbe, Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, in 1940. So he arrives before the war. Well, the war had already started in Europe, but the war hasn't started for America. Okay, but there's another character.
The Bostoner? When did he come?
I don't know when the Bostoner came. I don't know. It's a good question.
He was in the Mayflower. Huh? Right?
Came in the Mayflower. Yeah, I think it was before. Yeah, yeah. So, the Lubavitch has a very important figure who most people never heard of. And that is the Malach. What's a Malach? An angel. Have you ever heard of someone being referred to as a Malach?
My father used to tell me that there was a group called
the Malachim. Okay, so let's learn about the Malachim. Okay, good. So the Malach was Reb Chaim Avram Dovber Levine HaKohen. Now, whenever you have a name Levine HaKohen, what does that tell you? Well, it usually means that somebody switched places with someone else for draft purposes, because it wasn't your real last name, but you adopted that last name to escape the influence of Tsarist recruiters. But the Malach came to America in 1923. He had been the tutor of the 6th Lubavitch Rebbe, the Friedrich Rebbe, Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson. He was a disciple of the 5th Rebbe and the tutor of the 6th Rebbe, but they had a falling out. So the Malach was loyal and devoted to the teachings of the Chabad dynasty, but not of the present Rebbe, which is always a dangerous thing, because what does that mean? It means you're a competitor to the same dynasty. You're not an entirely other entity. You're within the same camp, but you don't like the guy in charge now. You're worse because you know all the secrets, where the bodies are buried. Okay, so he establishes a Lubavitch shul in the Bronx on Washington Avenue and 169th Street. And he is an old world kind of person. He wants the Jews of America to have a beard, pay us, sits us down to the floor, kapota, don't speak English, only speak Yiddish, don't give your children a secular education, definitely no college. Divorce yourself from the modern world entirely. Entirely. Now, is that possible in the Bronx in the 1920s? I mean, who's the king of the Bronx in the 1920s? Babe Ruth. I mean, you can't exactly completely separate yourself from the culture around you. But yet he wants to try.
Wasn't it as strong as far as
Yes, the Bronx between the 1920s and 1940s was heavily Jewish. Okay. In 1948, there were more Jews in the Bronx than in the state of Israel. Yeah. You're right, it didn't take much. So, the influence of the Malach. When we discuss in a few moments Torah Vadas, we'll see that Shraga Feiva Mendelowitz, or Mendelovich, depending how you want to pronounce it, he was interested in taking Americanized boys and exposing them to a more fervent type of orthodoxy. Because if the student population in Torah Vadas was coming from homes that were not necessarily the most frum. And he wanted to show them what real Yiddishkeit could be about. So there were weekly trips to the Malach. But what happened? It worked too well. It backfired. And so students from Torah Vadas took the Malach's warnings to heart, and they changed their appearance, their attire, they grew the payas, they became troublemakers religiously for their parents who were not as frum, and for the school. And this was bad news all around, from the Torah Vadas point of view. So Mendelovich, he expelled everybody who were the followers of the Malach in 1931 and cut off all contact with them. No more. But this group became devoted followers and moved to Williamsburg, where they developed a style of life that was consistent with what we might call Hungarian Hasidism, of real extremism. And they associated themselves with Satmar after the war. Wow. Once the Reb Yoel came, there was close connection between the Malachim and Satmar. So here you have what began as a Lubavitch offshoot becomes an adjunct of Satmar. Now between 1946-7 and the early 80s, between the late 40s and early 80s, relations between Satmar and Lubavitch were very tense, with episodes of violence, which we'll talk about when we discuss Lubavitch maybe in about 5-6 weeks from now. But it got very bad at times. And whenever the Satmar were called out by the general Jewish community or by the higher, you know, ranking officials within Lubavitch, you know, you've gone too far, you've stepped over the line with an assault on a physical assault on somebody, the standard Satmar response was, it wasn't us, it was the Malachim. It was the Malachim. The Malachim became like the Erev Rav. The Bnei Yisrael blame the Erev Rav for everything. So blame the Malachim, because they're the ones who really hate your guts. And the Malach himself died in 1938, but the movement continued. And this small core, it continues to exist to this day. The men were strong in their attachment to that movement. The women less so. The women were miserable. And it wasn't easy to find wives for the Malachim men, because the women often would run away. It was really the most cult-like of all the Hasidic groups in America in mid-20th century, the Malachim. Okay. Now let's turn back to the yeshivas, away from Hasidus. So, Torah Vadas was founded in 1917 by modern Orthodox Jews who intended to create basically a day school. When Mendelovich was hired in 1921 as principal, he shifted the school to the right. Not extremely to the right, the Malachim was too much for him, he expelled that crowd, but considerably further to the right than your Americanized Orthodox Jews of Williamsburg in 1917. And what kind of education was he hoping to give these boys? Well, elementary education at first, and the advanced yeshiva wasn't established until 1926, when they developed a high school as a competition to TA, to Talmudic Academy, under Revel's auspices. So Revel and Mendelovich were competitors for the same student population, basically speaking. I mean, yes, one was in Brooklyn and one was in Manhattan, but there's only so many students to go around, and each one wants to grab whoever he can get. All right. Rietz was an impressive yeshiva. Rietz was a very impressive yeshiva. They had the Major Eliyahu, Shlomo Palachek, from 1922 to 1928. And then, with the move uptown to Washington Heights, Ramosha Soloveitchik comes in 1929. And certain big gedolim from Eastern Europe came and went back and forth during the 20s and 30s. So you had Shimon Shkup, was there for over a year. You had even Rav Aaron Cutler came and gave shiur for a while in 1935. Well, they came. These guys came to collect money. They wanted fundraisers. Yeah. So Rav Baruch Baer came to Rietz, Avram Bloch. Yeah, very briefly, but yes, they made an appearance. Always on a fundraising mission. Now the question was, could Revel succeed in keeping these folks in America? I mean, if someone comes to America, wants to raise money for a yeshiva in Eastern Europe, but once they're here, who's to say they're going to want to go back? Well, usually they do want to go back, but sometimes you can convince someone it's worth your while to stay to teach Torah in America.
Rebbe
Elchanan, 1938, declined to come to YU, and Revel was very much disappointed and offended by that, because Rebbe Elchanan went to Torah Vadas, but not to Rietz uptown. Okay. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. Yeah.
It cost him his life.
Yes. Yes. He died in 1941. He was shot because he had opportunities to escape and he didn't.
He went back.
He went back.
Went back
willingly. Yeah.
He knew what he was going to do.
Yeah. So, Torah V'Das wants to be an advanced yeshiva, competing with Ritz, and identifying to the right of Ritz. So they need to have a big Rosh Yeshiva, or at least an impressive Rosh Yeshiva, to do this. So what happens is, Rendelovich hires Reb David Leibowitz. Reb David Leibowitz was a big Talmud of the Chafetz Chaim, one of the last of the big Talmidim of the Chafetz Chaim in Radin, in the yeshiva in Radin. And he comes to America in 1929, and he's hired by Torah V'Das. But it doesn't last very long. It lasts until 1933, at which point in time he leaves. Why does he leave? Because Reb David Leibowitz is an old world Rosh Yeshiva, a fairly young man, not such an old man. He died relatively young in 1941. But he can't get along with a modern place like Torah V'Das. Now, is Torah V'Das such a modern place? Everything is by comparison. There's a spectrum here. You can't put anything into a strict category. There is a spectrum, and so Reb David Leibowitz was to the right of Torah V'Das, and he had to get out. So where does he go? He makes his own yeshiva, Bedford Avenue in Williamsburg. He makes Rabbinical Seminary of America, known as Yeshiva Chafetz Chaim, which moves to Forest Hills in 1955 and moves to Kew Garden Hills in 2003. Has a very nice campus today in Kew Garden Hills. He doesn't last that long as Rosh Yeshiva. He dies relatively young in 1941. His son, Reb Henoch Leibowitz, takes over and is the Rosh Yeshiva for 67 years, from 1941 to 2008 when he passes away. So that's an impressive run as a Rosh Yeshiva. Chafetz Chaim differed from Torah V'Das. I don't just mean ideologically. I mean also in the agenda, the goal of the education. Torah V'Das wanted to produce learned and committed balabatim. That was the goal. Not to be a factory of gedolim or even mechanchim and rabbanim. That's not to say nobody went into the rabbinate from Torah V'Das. Some people did. Although sometimes as an afterthought. But they wanted balabatim. That was the goal. Whereas Yeshiva Chafetz Chaim, the emphasis was in learning, not only on Gemara, but also Musar. I mean, the Chafetz Chaim himself was a great Baal Midos, Shmir Saloshon, the Sefer Chafetz Chaim itself. Okay, so there's an emphasis on good and decent and ethical behavior, and that translates into the nature of the curriculum, as opposed to some of the other yeshivas that did not want to have any emphasis on Musar and Midos, just wanted to have strict Talmud Torah all day long. But the other is that the graduates of Chafetz Chaim should go into Jewish service, whether as Rabbanim or as teachers in the yeshivas, and that there was a zeal for this kind of public service. Not just that you do it because you couldn't get another job in another line of work, which is often the case with people in the religion business, but there, it was because it's the right thing to do, that Klal Yisrael needs your efforts to sustain traditional Judaism. Okay, so I used a dirty word just now, graduates. That's a bad word when it comes to the advanced yeshivas. When it comes to elementary school yeshivas, and even the high school, the masiftas, you understand that there are grade levels, and at some point, you graduate, you're done. You've passed 8th grade, you passed 12th grade, you're out. But the advanced yeshivas in America, as they are developing, want to emulate the style of the advanced yeshivas of Eastern Europe, where nobody graduates. You at some point take leave of the yeshiva because you're moving on in life. But lav dafka, not necessarily because you've been ordained or you've been there X number of years. Life circumstance will dictate when you go. But you could stay indefinitely for many, many years because the Talmud Torah can get kulam. Learning is the most important thing of them all. All right? So it's not for the diploma. It's for lishma. The focus on Torah Lishma, that is the emphasis of the advanced yeshivas. And the criticism of the smicha factories is that there wasn't Torah Lishma, but it was Torah for the sake of a diploma. And then to get a job, and to stay in the religion business, the industry. And that's a very harsh criticism, a fair one sometimes, but a very harsh criticism. Where was there a smicha factory, so to speak, in America that was established in the 1920s in Chicago, the Skokie Yeshiva, Hebrew Theological College. That was established not as a conventional Eastern European-style yeshiva for Talmud Torah Lishma, but rather it was established as a theological seminary or theological college with an official curriculum, a program from which one would study and graduate and be an ordained rabbi. Why did such a place need to exist? Well, because you need communal rabbonim, congregational rabbonim, in areas beyond the Eastern Seaboard. And absent Skokie's existence, you really wouldn't have had that. So their graduates typically served in so-called traditional synagogues, where there might not have been a mechitza, but otherwise the style of the service was in keeping with the tradition. And the relationship of those graduates and of HTC with, let's say, Reitz and the Rabbinical Council of America is a delicate one in the 1920s and 30s, but eventually an amalgamation, and they're on the same wavelength. Okay, so we've covered Torah Vadas, Hebrew Theological College, Chafetz Chaim, yeah. Yeah. Right,
yeah.
Right. The external trappings of old world orthodoxy, of ghetto orthodoxy, were anathema at that time.
And then apparently Rav Pelkowitz would say, Shloshim for one of his relatives, and he had a beard.
Yeah.
And they said, well, why don't you keep it? And he said, no, I promised Rav Mendelovich that I'm going to.
Ah, wow.
So this is an attitude which was different from.
Right, so this was contra the malachim, the polar opposite end. Yeah.
Further on the line with Mendelovich, when David Stern got his PhD in math from Columbia, he was going to become an instructor there. And he wore a yarmulke. They would not allow
him. They wouldn't take him, yeah.
And he had argued with them, what do you mean? All these years I've been wearing a yarmulke here as a student. He says, as a student, that's okay. Not as an instructor in this institution.
Yeah.
Mendelovich got wind of that.
He hired him as the principal.
He hired him as the principal. The man had no cred for being a principal. He would have been a good English teacher. They hired him because he used that as a selling point in recruiting students with modern Orthodox parents.
Right.
They were there. We have a principal who is a Columbia PhD.
Yeah. Well, it's a good selling point.
He was there for over 50 years. And at the same time, he was the Young Israel, the movement's rabbi. They, the Young Israel rabbi, and he was the rabbi of the Young Israel.
So, another yeshiva that gets overlooked, we'll get to Chaim Berlin in a second. Another yeshiva gets overlooked is the New Haven yeshiva. You never heard of the New Haven yeshiva, did you?
Yeah,
never.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, some people heard of it. Okay, so the yeshiva of New Haven was founded by Rav Yehuda Levenberg. He became the chief rabbi of New Haven in 1917. He had been previously in Jersey City. He came in 1917. He establishes the school in 1923. There were very high-level students who went to that yeshiva, including Rav Scheinberg, who was a Talmud in New Haven. And the yeshiva moved to Cleveland in 1929 for reasons that are not exactly clear. But having gone to Cleveland, some big rabbonim became magidei shir. They were lecturers in that yeshiva. Rav Ruderman, Yaakov Ruderman, was the son-in-law of Shechtel Kramer. Shechtel Kramer was one of the Rashi yeshiva there, who had made the move from New Haven to Cleveland. And so Rav Ruderman also taught there until he left in 1933 to do what? Establish Neir Yisroel, which we'll talk about soon. Rav Moshe Feinstein left Luban in Russia in 1936, and his first job in America? Cleveland. And the New Haven yeshiva in Cleveland, the Beis Medrash L'Rabbonim.
He was a shamus. He was his first job out of a shamus out there. And then he moved up
the ranks.
Realized that he was more than just a shamus.
Well, he wasn't there very long. He was only there about a year and a half. And then 1938 makes his way to MTJ, Masifta Tiferes Yerushalayim. Now the school closed in 1938 when Rav Levenberg died, but the very fact that it existed in Cleveland proved important in the long run. Why? Because when Yeshivas Tells was in the path of the Nazi army. They had to run. Unlike the Mir, which escaped basically intact, Tells was overrun. A lot of Talmidim and Magid Eshir were killed. But Rav Bloch and Rav Katz survived. They went across Siberia to Japan, to Seattle, and then made their way to Cleveland. And October 28th, 1941, they reestablished Tells in Cleveland. And they had to recruit students, and there was a whole process of bringing it back to life, but the yeshiva continued. But why Cleveland? Because there had been a yeshiva there, and in the words of Rav Katz, the fires of Torah were burning in Cleveland. So that's why they chose that city. Truth be told, there was a need for these kind of yeshivas away from New York. Because, whether it's Baltimore, as we'll see in Eretz Yisrael in a second, or Chicago, or Cleveland, there were Jews looking to give their sons an advanced level yeshiva training. And these Jews lived away from the major urban areas on the East Coast where there were strong concentrations of Orthodox Jews. Now, why might such people exist out in the boonies? The answer is they might have been the rabbi of the town, the shochet of the town, some kind of clay kodesh, some religious functionary who probably had elite yeshiva training back in Europe and feels bad that his own son can't have that in America. There may be nobody else in town who wants it, and so there can't be one in their own locale, but there should be one at least regionally. Why should all of the boys have to be shipped off to New York, to Brooklyn? It's a long way. Travel isn't so easy back then. So regional centers of Torah are very important, and they serve a good purpose. Okay. And what about Ner Yisroel? So Rav Ruderman goes to Baltimore in 1933, and he takes a job as a pulpit rabbi. And there's only a very small core of fervently Orthodox Jews in the city at that time. There were Orthodox shuls, for sure, but I mean fervently Orthodox Jews, to keep him happy. And so he takes the job on one condition, that he's allowed to establish a yeshiva. And so he does. And Israel is a small local institution at first, but definitely grows and grows and grows to the point of being, in Baltimore, yeah, to the point of being one of the major yeshivas in America. Not just elementary, but high school and beyond, and to offer smicha as well. Okay. Chaim Berlin. Chaim Berlin was not Chaim Berlin. Chaim Berlin was Yeshiva Tiferes Bachrim. Now, the word Bachrim implies what? Young kids. It was an elementary school. It was established in 1906 in Brownsville as the first yeshiva in Brooklyn. The first yeshiva in Brooklyn. Elementary school. Not especially well run. Not the best of reputation for scholastically. Okay, and it was an elementary school that was roughly along the lines of Torah Vadas in the interwar period. It did not gain renown until the arrival of Rav Huttner in 1939. That's a long stint. That's a long stint to be elementary school yeshiva, maybe a high school as well. By the 20s, they had a high school, but it served its purpose for the Jewish people in Brownsville, East New York, New Lots, that part of Eastern Brooklyn. Yeah. Eitz Chaim of the Lower East Side was 1886. Eitz Chaim of Borough Park was 1912. Yeah. So now, the thing about Chaim Berlin is, why did it change its name? Well, who was Chaim Berlin? The man. So Chaim Berlin was the son of the Netziv from the first wife. So he was an older brother to Meir Berlin, Meir Bar Ilan. And Meir Bar Ilan was in America in the 19-teens, a tumbler from Mizrahi. And when his brother died in 1912, his brother had been a Rav in Moscow, he suggested to the yeshiva, Tiferes Bachrim, that they rename the school in memory of his brother. So it became Yeshiva Chaim Berlin. So the name of the yeshiva came about because of the influence of the leader of Americanized Zionism, Orthodox Zionism, but the school would evolve to have something of an anti-Zionist flavor to it later on. Not so strong, not, you know, to the likes of Satmar or the Turekata, but, you know, mainstream non-Zionist or anti-Zionist Haredi Judaism. When Rav Huttner came in 1939, he was the most successful of all the Russia yeshiva. Now, I just made a subjective statement, but I'll stand by it. He was the most successful of all the Russia yeshiva of his generation in developing a cult of the personality. His Talmidim loved him and were devoted to him. Not even so much to the yeshiva, but to him. So when he would fight with the board of directors, he would threaten, I'll take the whole yeshiva and start it new under my auspices. And you can't fight with me because I have control over the student population. He had been a Talmud in Hebron. He was there around the time of the massacre. He had studied in Europe in the university briefly, but, you know, went away from that mode of thought and came to America as a Rosh Yeshiva.
American born.
Huh?
I thought he was American.
No. He was born in Europe. Studied in Slabodka. He learned it well. Yeah, he learned it well. Okay. So, these are basically speaking, all the yeshivas that existed, the major yeshivas that existed before the war began. The Mir began in 1947, after the war. After they left Shanghai, some of the yeshiva went to Yerushalayim, and some of the yeshiva went to Brooklyn. And the Brooklyn faction established itself in Flatbush. Yeah.
But Chaim Berlin, I think, was trying to establish a secular department.
Okay.
Yes. They went through the process.
So they went through the process of getting accreditation in New York State. And they were successful in getting all the paperwork in order, but the school never came into existence. Now, why create a school as a competitor to Yeshiva College? The answer is there is no good answer. The same motivation for establishing Yeshiva College was motivating the Chaim Berlin audience to establish their own kind of school. And what was that motivation? Not really a Torah Umada synthesis. It was the convenience of having a college on the premises of the yeshiva so that the boys wouldn't have to have the practical hassle of going to Brooklyn College at night. So you save yourself the effort, the tircha, of going here and there and everywhere. Because all sorts of bizarre permutations of college enrollment existed among the yeshiva crowd in the mid-20th century. Just before the war, then in the decade after the war, of night school, two nights a week, three nights a week, four nights a week, this hour, that hour, extension courses, everything, but actually attending a regular school. Why? Because in your main hours of the day, you want to be a devoted full-time Talmud to the yeshiva. But it's not. It's uncomfortable. It's unpleasant. It's an unpleasant experience. It also takes too long. That was another factor. It takes many years to graduate college when you're limiting the number of courses you can take in any one year because you have limited time. So if you have a school in the yeshiva, you can make it a regular four-year course and boom, you're done. All right. Plus, you can not cheat the system, but you can get credits for Judaic studies, which was what they intended to do, and which is what Bernard Lander successfully did with Turo after 1970. All right. So I left out one yeshiva. It's the yeshiva that's founded during the war, and it's the most important yeshiva in America. And what's that? Lakewood. Okay, so what happened to Lakewood? So Rav Aaron Cutler came to the United States in 1935 on a tour, and he made the rounds. But he went back to Europe. So he was the Rosh Yeshiva in Kletsk. And he fled in 1940, made his way across Russia through Siberia, and arrives in San Francisco, and then makes his way to New York, where he is known as an illustrious Rosh Yeshiva, but without a position. So, well, what do you do? Well, there was a kollel in White Plains, not far from my part of the world, Westchester County, a kollel in White Plains of about 15 guys. And they asked Rav Aaron Cutler to be their Rosh Kollel. And he agreed, but on one condition, that they would establish a yeshiva, but it would have to move. It couldn't be too close to New York. He wanted Torah Lishma, but he wanted without any distractions. So Irving Bunim suggested to him Lakewood. Why Lakewood? It's close enough to New York that you can get back to the, you know, the core of settlement, to Brooklyn, to the Lower East Side when you really need to, but it's far enough away that basically you don't have a day-to-day distraction. It's a quiet area, you know, an hour out of town, this will be the perfect spot. Hour and a half, whatever, that depends on traffic, depends how fast they drove. But you should know that Rav Aaron Cutler, his commute took a little bit longer. And you know why? Huh? Well, he lived in Borough Park, number one, but also he wouldn't use Easy Pass. When they had the tokens for the bridges, he insisted that his driver take him to the lane that had a human teller, a clerk. He said, "It's covered abrius. We need to give them parnasa. You don't use the tokens. Go to the person and pay them the fare." All right. Okay. So he established Beis Medrash Gavoa in 1943, and it began as a very small institution, but it grew over time, in part because RJJ was a feeder to Lakewood. There were a lot of connections between the two.
I can just flesh it out. It was Irving Bunim.
Irving Bunim was the connection between
Irving
the two.
Irving Bunim was the president of RJJ, and he was the godfather of Lakewood.
Right.
And he arranged that the last year before Smicha, the last year that Talmidim had to learn in Lakewood, and then come back to New York. That's what kept Lakewood going for a while.
Yeah. For a long while, until it took on a life of its own, and the town itself became an attraction for Haredi Jewry. It wasn't just the yeshiva.
A few houses in the late 50s.
Right, it wasn't much. It wasn't much at all. So, now, the bigger issue here is, why does any of this matter, what we spoke about tonight? What could have happened, was that in the post-war era, if things had turned out differently, American Judaism would have come to be dominated by the conservative movement and to a lesser extent the reform movement, with Orthodoxy being a very marginal fringe aspect of American Jewish life, predominantly a modern Orthodox variety, and the right-wing world being a non-factor. Everybody was killed in the Shoah, and assimilation is rampant in America, no yeshiva movement. That could have happened, but that's not what happened. In fact, after the war, you have the influx of about 50 to 100,000 Jews between 1946 and 1951 who were professing Orthodox Jews, whether of the Hasidic variety, usually Hungarian Hasidim, because the Polish Hasidim for the most part killed, and Misnagdim, who had an affinity for the world of the yeshiva in the past and wanted to recreate that here in America. So it worked itself out for a few reasons. One, America was ready for it. America was ready for cultural pluralism in the post-war era. Now, that's not to say that there was no anti-Semitism. Of course there was. But unlike in the year 1900, when the tradition was Anglo-Saxon conformity, you have to do what the WASPs do, or in the interwar period where it was melting pot, but melting pot means that if you have a curious or odd culture from the past, you're going to give up a lot of that for the melting pot of America. In the post-war era, cultural pluralism meant that if you were a religious oddity, a freak, basically. I'm not going to say that about Hasidim or Jews, but let's say other religious denominations, you know, Mormonism, bizarre Christian denominations, everybody's entitled to do whatever they want to do. And we're not going to stop you. There's no insistence that you give up your ways, your very different ways, for that of some distinctly American style. So the cultural pluralism plays an important role. Secondly, economic success. The yeshivas are always crying poverty. But for all that they're crying poverty, they continue to exist. And that couldn't have happened in the Depression era. It couldn't happen in the early period of Eastern European immigration. Why? Because there wasn't the resources available to sustain yeshivas. Number one, people couldn't pay tuition. And forget tuition, nobody paid tuition. The yeshiva fed and housed everyone. Where was the money for that? As it was, Reitz was barely hanging on. The JTS was barely hanging on, if not for the rich Reform Jews who gave them hundreds of thousands of dollars. So the money available in the post-war era allows the yeshivas to function. Also, another factor is the delay in mature adulthood. In an earlier era, a person in their late teen years was already a grown person who had to fend for themselves, who was expected to provide parnasa for the family, to go to work, even get married. Life started a lot earlier back then. But in the post-war era, there, where it became acceptable for middle-class people to go to college, so until the age of 22, you're not really a grown adult, you're still on the parents' dole. So for the yeshiva world, the same thing could hold true. You could be not a functioning adult, but a student of an advanced yeshiva of high-level Talmud, but not out and about in the world until a later juncture in life, which gives the opportunity not just for 1 year of yeshiva study, but for two, three, four, who knows how many. Some people went for 5-6 years to advanced yeshiva. But the most important factor that allowed for this to develop was the fact that it already was in place before 1945. Had there not been an earlier presence of a strong orthodoxy in America, then the crowd that came as Holocaust survivors could not have done what they did. Yes, they were instrumental in elevating the halakhic standards of many of the shuls and the kahilas and imposing chumras that some people didn't like from the Americanized crowd. All that's true, but none of that could have happened without the groundwork that was laid by the earlier generation. There were already shuls, there were already mikvahs, there were already kashrus supervision mechanisms, and there was already Reitz, Torah Vadas, Chaim Berlin, Ner, Chofetz Chaim, and the like. All this predates the Sherus HaPleita, the remnant that comes from the DP camps.
Did Satmar go it alone?
Basically? So Satmar went it alone. Yes, you're right. That the community of Williamsburg and then eventually also Borough Park that includes Satmar, Vizhnitz, Papa, Munkach, Babov, that has nothing to do with what I spoke about tonight. It really doesn't.
Yeah, but it strengthened.
One strengthens the other, because if you have a critical mass of people who are keeping kosher, let's say, then you have the infrastructure of buying food. If you have a critical mass of people who need synagogues, yes, you might not go to the same one, but the earlier arrivals have to go somewhere. They're going to go to your shul. By the way, there were plenty of Chassidim who were musmachim of Torah Vadas. Why? Because in the earliest phases, there was no Chassidish yeshiva. That gets built, very soon. Every dynasty will build its besmedrish, they'll call it. But that doesn't happen the first day. And especially if the Rebbe arrives in 47, or 48, or 49, or 55, or 56, and lays down his roots on 13th Avenue or in Williamsburg, what was happening for the decade before that, for the people who came earlier? There were only Misnagdash yeshivas. So there were Chassidim who were graduates of Torah Vadas. Now, who else graduated from Torah Vadas? And this will be the last point for tonight.
Rabbis.
Huh? Okay, so Reform rabbis also graduated Torah Vadas. The rabbi of Temple Emmanuel in Great Neck, Rabbi Robert S. Whittem, with whom I got into a few fights in my earlier years when I was more of a fiery character, he was a graduate of Torah Vadas and became a Reform rabbi.
Why?
He was a charlatan. Simple as that.
Yuhavi Lawrence, the current rabbi of
Temple Israel, yeah.
He was Orthodox.
Right.
He took the job, and he's more Reformed than the Reformer. Services on Saturday.
Right. Okay, so it's true that you had graduates of the right-wing yeshivas who became heterodox rabbis, sometimes even Reform rabbis, not just conservative. But I was going in a different direction. The last point that I want to make for tonight was the leading expositor of modern Orthodoxy, capital M, capital O, in the second half of the 20th century, was a graduate of Torvadas High School. And who is that?
Norman Lamb.
Norman Lamb, class of 1945. All right. So, in the 1940s into the 50s, this is a real tug of war. Where will the intellectually oriented graduates of the right-wing yeshivas of Brooklyn, and here I mean just really Chaim Berlin and Tor Vadas, where will they go for college? Will they go to a secular college and remain in Brooklyn in that orbit, in the right-wing yeshiva world? Or will they expand their horizons and go up to Washington Heights, 185th Street? And in some cases this way, in some cases that way. But some of the leading figures had their start in Brooklyn. Now, who had his start in Chaim Berlin? Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, class of 1949. So we see that you can leave Brooklyn and those yeshivas, despite having had good, very excellent relations with Rav Huttner. Rav Lichtenstein credits Rav Huttner as being one of his great influences in life. But still, people look to expand their horizons in a different direction. So some of them went to YU. Got a question? Okay. Yeah.
Mir.
Rav Kalmanovich was a Rosh Yeshiva in Mir.
He was a Rav. He's the executive director in Europe.
He didn't go to Israel. He went to America. Yeah. And with Shmuel Birnbaum established the Mir, which made its way to Avenue R and Ocean Parkway, and became a very important institution.
Shmuel Birnbaum was a son-in-law of Rav Kalmanovich.
Okay, right. So, and the thing about the Mir was that although it was in a world of right-wing orthodoxy, its elementary school and high school, secularly, was actually quite good. I had teachers in Hafter who were musmachim of the Mir, who had gone through the system, 12 grades plus then Bes Medrash, and they said that it was a very strong secular education.
Rabbi Brisman?
Rabbi Brisman was, yeah.
My contemporary.
Okay. So that yeshiva is the most important of the immediate post-war yeshivas, the transplanted ones that made it after the war, as opposed to Tells, which was transplanted during the war, and the others, which were created de novo. Not Yesh Ma'ayin, but close to it.
Square?
After the war. Rav Tversky comes to America after the war. The puppet Salem, yeah. So the Salem were in Williamsburg in the early 30s. In the early 30s, there was a small kahila, but they never became a big group. But the
they were involved in
that's true, and they're also involved in matzah baking. Okay, we'll stop here.